I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation Cure Master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com.
Vicious, vicious vodka. Oh, you did that. Got me on this corner. And
you're listening to Cooking Issues Radio on the Heritage Radio Network, coming to you live every Tuesday from 12 to 12:45. I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues, and we're here with Nastasha the Hammer Lopez. Call in all your questions to the studio at 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. So today we're being sponsored by S. Wallace Edwards, the ham company. I happen to know Sam Edwards personally, who makes that ham. Ham happens to be country ham in particular, although I know, Nastasha, you're more of a prosciutto head.
That's true.
Yeah, but American country ham happens to be one of my favorite subjects in the whole world, so maybe I'll talk for a second about country ham before we get into anything else. Sam Edwards country ham, our sponsor today. His family has been in Surrey for, probably a couple hundred years, something like that. Surrey is across the river from Smithfield, which is kind of the well-known name in American country hams. They don't really make a good country ham in Smithfield anymore, but Sam Edwards really does. And he mentioned that his grandfather started the business. His grandfather actually wrote an interesting article back, I think, in sometime in the 60s, and it was about peanut-fed hogs. You used to be, everyone talks about the Bayota-fed hogs that you get out of Spain that make the best, most delicious ham. And in fact, they do make delicious ham because the acorns that these Spanish hogs eat give them they have a lot of unsaturated fat, and it changes the fat characteristics of the ham, which means that the ham has this awesome taste that you can't really get any other way. But the only reason that's really preserved, I think, in Spain is because the economics are such that they're not allowed to chop down the forest where those nuts are produced, so that they have the ability to produce it, whereas we don't. Our hams used to kick a similar level of butt. In fact, we're world kind of known. I mean, our curing techniques are amazing. And so Sam Edwards' grandfather actually wrote an interesting article, I think in the 60s, or was quoted in one, saying that ham production is going to hell in a handbasket because we're not feeding the peanuts anymore. We have a lower slaughter weight than we used to. Mm-hmm. Because, the older a pig is when you kill it, the more the enzymes, and the enzyme profile in an older hog is different from the one in a younger hog. And a larger, older hog, aside from being bigger, that can take more age, also the enzyme profile is different, which is going to lead to a better tasting ham. So these are all things that we've done. But that aside, American curing is totally different from any other kind of curing, ham curing, and it's a totally different product. Like, should not be confused with prosciutto, should not be confused with the Serrano. Like, these are, like, actual American treasures. And so Sam Edwards is one of the few people who's, still a fairly large production. In other words, you can buy it here in New York. He can ship. He's USDA. That is doing a very traditional, great American product. And traditional in Virginia would be kind of a heavy smoke on his hams. And you can make sure you get ones for him that are, a year or older. And then actually, I'm traveling tomorrow to Kentucky. I'm going to tour another great ham producer, Finchfield Farms. Finchfield Farms out of Kentucky is another great old producer, and a lot of the people who produce hams in Kentucky, so think Finchfield, think Colonel Newsom's, which is Nancy Mahaffey's ham place. These are people also who've been curing for hundreds of years, not them personally, but their families. And a lot of these guys moved to Kentucky back when Kentucky was still Virginia. So I will be visiting Finchfield Farms tomorrow, actually. It's the first time I've been there, so I'm excited, along with obviously drinking a lot of bourbon. So we'll probably talk about that more next week. Although next week, Nastasha, we might be doing the show live from...
We are doing it from London.
Live from London, huh? So we're going to... Our second road show is going to be in London, because next week, we're going to be out in London doing the... What's the name of the show we're doing, Nastasha? Do you even know?
It's just called the London Cocktail Week. London, and, yeah.
So we're doing rotary evaporation over there?
Yes, with Oxlegen.
Yeah, which is a vacuum distillation technique, for those of you who don't know what the heck I'm talking about. Right?
Yes.
Yeah? Mm, okay. Anyway, let's go on to some questions, because we have some email questions from before, if I can just find them. Oh my gosh, Nastasha, I've lost the email questions.
No. Well, the first one's an answer.
Oh, that's right. So some of you might recall several weeks ago, we tried to answer the question. What was her name again?
Colleen was the big girl.
Yeah, Colleen, she's a very tall woman, and she was having problems with countertop heights. And we called Mark Ladner. Mark Ladner is the newest 4-star chef in New York City, because Del Posto, his restaurant, just got upgraded to 4 stars in the New York Times. So congratulations. And he is tall. He's 6'4". And so here's what he wrote back. We asked him, how do you deal with this problem of being very tall? He said, when I was younger, I often hunched over, which was obviously horrible for my back and neck. When I built Del Posto, I had a kitchen designer who recommended a 42-inch counter, which is higher than our normal, 36, mm-hmm, 35 36. Counter, which he had recently designed for Grey Kunz, who's also, I guess, tall. And he says that this counter is a lifesaver. And he says, most, except for the very short, love it. And he doesn't see any reason why, it was Colleen, right, should not be allowed to use her special adapter unless it's unsafe or unsanitary. And he hopes that that's helpful. Okay, so nice. we have a caller. Caller, you are on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Going well.
Awesome. Well, I've always heard that if you burn garlic when making a tomato sauce, it's going to make your sauce bitter. I was wondering if you could tell me why.
That is true story. I don't know why. It kind of caught me off guard. I mean, garlic is pretty complex and easy to burn because it's got a high sugar content. I think that's why it burns so easy. But I don't like that acrid burnt taste that you get. I don't know exactly what's going on. It has to be like all of the interesting stuff with garlic has to do. I mean, garlic doesn't really have that much of its characteristic sharp, pungent flavor until it's been cut, right? So what happens is that there's enzymes in the garlic, and when you cut it or crush it, those enzymes are acting on I always forget the names. It's like alanin and allicin and all these ala blah, blah, blahs. Like, there are like these chemicals that start out being relatively odorless and then develop all of their pungency after they're cut, and then are modified more or less by cooking. And since those are the chemicals that lead to the pungency, I would think that those are also the ones that lead to kind of those acrid flavors when they're cooked or when they get burnt. But I can't say for sure. There is an excellent book out on the subject. It's called, I believe it's called Garlic and Other Alliums, something like that. It's lore. I just bought it. I actually read it, but it's very dense. So I can't remember whether there was any explanation of it because it was too much to look into. But next week, we have Harold. We have a list of stuff to ask Harold from the radio show.
We can make one.
Let's make a list. Mm-hmm. And I'll ask him that, whether he knows specifically what it is, because he's read that book and spoke with that person. So he's thought a lot about that kind of a problem. That's something I should know off the top of my head, but do not.
Okay.
I do know, however, when you pressure cook garlic, it actually destroys a lot of the pungency, so that in fact you know how even when you roast garlic, when you roast it, still if you eat a lot of it, it comes out of your pores over the course of several days, and your coworkers don't want to be anywhere near you. Again, I know this from awful experience. When you pressure cook garlic, those principles are gone, and you can actually eat a whole bunch of garlic without. In fact, we make sauces that are upwards of 50% garlic, and no one has a problem with them, and it's a very mellow flavor, and it's because a lot of those sulfur-containing compounds that are in the garlic that give it its pungency are kind of destroyed by the high heat on the inside of a pressure cooker. So we will keep a list.
Yes.
Okay, so we have Colin Gore writes in and says he has a handful of things on his mind lately. So let's look at those handful of things that are on his mind. Colin's built a vacuum chamber using a compressor harvested from a window-mounted air conditioner to make a vacuum. I love this kind of DIY kind of do-it-yourself kind of stuff. And he says it works wonderfully. But he's wondering about running it for more than a few minutes at a time because he's afraid he's going to burn it out. I wouldn't worry about it so much. The kind of the great granddaddy of websites dealing with this problem is called the bell jar, and a bell jar being an old vacuum thing that you put things in vacuum, the bell jar. So the bell jar, and it's based on a bunch of articles published a long, long time ago in Scientific American, The Amateur Scientist, which were fantastic. Like, I had one when I was a kid, like how to build lasers, amazing stuff. Scientific American's old Amateur Scientist column, freaking amazing, amazing stuff. Anyway, the bell jar has a list of these things, and it talks a lot about making vacuum pumps cheaply out of air conditioning units and refrigeration units. And a lot of what the capabilities of your unit are depend on whether it's a rotary pump or whether it's a piston pump. Most refrigerator compressors are piston pumps, and they're not going to operate nearly as well at low vacuum as these rotary pumps are. So so a lot of air conditioners have a rotary pump. So as long as you keep the thermal overload switch on the pump, you should be fine, because if it cuts out, it's not going to get hurt. You also obviously have to make sure that you didn't let the oil drain out of it. Otherwise, it's going to burn out very quickly. But you should be able to run it no problem. If it's overheating, you'll be able to tell because it's exposed. He also makes a good note. Please don't just cut out a compressor out of an air conditioner and let the Freon spray everywhere, because you're opening yourself up to a fine and you're destroying the environment. I might also say don't use a saw when you're cutting a compressor off of something, because the little filings can get into the compressor, and then that's bad, 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 bad news. Colin has more questions, but first I think we're going to go to a caller. Yeah. Caller, you are on the air.
Hello, it's Joe here from London, Dave.
Hey, how you doing? We'll be out to see you in just a couple of, we'll be out in London in just a couple of days.
Oh, great. I hope to meet up with you. We've been really inspired by your blog and the show over here.
Oh, I appreciate it. I appreciate it.
Dave, my question is, I'd like to prepare large prawns, or I guess langoustine, or you may call them shrimp. I'm not sure.
Right.
I want to prepare them ahead of time, sous vide, and then finish them off on a grill so I can get some kind of maillard on them. I'm just not sure what kind of temperature to cook them at and for how long.
Right. All right, shrimp and prawns are interesting because they contain enzymes in them that if you cook them for extended periods of time, they go mushy. They turn to a paste, right?
Yep.
And so, vacuum and sous vide is a very, very good way, first of all, to infuse flavor into them, and also to make sure that, none of the flavor leaches out when you're cooking. But
okay.
But you're going to want to make sure that you do it fairly quickly. You want to make sure that it's cooked through in, like, I would keep it, if you can, under 12 minutes or something like that. Otherwise, you're going to start breaking it down. And a good thing to do is to run a test just to see what happens when you cook it for a long, long time. You'll see it just gets really nasty. One way to do it, if you like more traditional texture, is obviously to put the bag into a very high temp water. And that's what someone like Georges Pralut would do, where he cooks his shellfish almost in boiling water, even when it's in a vacuum bag. Another option, if you want to go more like the texture that people want off like a butter poached lobster or something like that, is to run it more like 65 degrees for like Celsius for like 10 to 12 minutes once it's out of its shell, obviously. You know what I mean? So that might be a similar thing you do with a prawn or a shrimp, but that's going to give you a soft texture, more akin to on the lower side of being done than on the higher side. And then obviously you could firm it up with your finishing step, with your finishing sear step, which is going to put more of a crust on the outside and get it done. But you really, the key thing with it is just to not cook it for too long, because it's going to be, and cool it down quick after it comes out, because it's just going to be a complete nightmare to you. You're going to get, you cannot believe how bad the texture of a long cooked, shrimp or prawn can be. I mean, it doesn't always happen, but it happens enough and you have to spit it out. It's like just terrible.
That's really what I was trying to avoid by doing the sous vide step, because I find that if I do it directly on the grill, if I'm doing like a large, say, like a 10-12 prawn, I can easily overcook it, and it gets very mushy and not a pleasant flavor at all.
Right. But you're going to flash finish them on this one, right? You're just going to pre-cook them and then flash finish them?
Yes, but I'd like to do them in the shell, because the shell adds a nice flavor when it's grilled, so... will that change the cooking times, do you think?
No, not much. The shells are usually pretty thick. You can do it head on too, or no?
Yes, head on too.
Yeah, because the head's the best part anyway. But the not the best part. It's delicious. That's what I mean to say.
Sure. Yeah.
But one thing you want to be really careful of is that the shells on shrimp and prawns almost always pop vacuum bags. So you're going to want to either double bag or wrap them in something to protect the bag and to make sure that you have, you know, the air doesn't come back into the chamber too fast, because you're going to start popping your bags. And after you pack them, you're going to want to let them sit for, it's good to let them sit to marinate anyway. If you're going to use like oil and salt and pepper or something, I mean, I don't know what your recipe is, but you know, inside the bag, you know, then you're going to want to let it sit for a half hour or so, not just to pick up the flavor of whatever you put in, but also to make sure you don't have any holes in it, right? Then I would go for a fairly quick cook, like maybe 10 to, I don't know the size of them, but like 10 minutes, 10 to 12 at like 65 or something like that, and pull them out, cool them down, and then do your flash finish almost from cold, because they'll already be cooked, and so you can cook them at high a heat as you want to get that nice color and taste on the outside of the shell without having to worry about cooking the inside.
Perfect, Dave. Perfect. Thank you so much.
All right, and please tell us your results. Like, write in and tell us whether it worked. This way I can see whether that worked.
Okay. I'll maybe even put some photos in as well.
Sounds great. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Dave. Bye.
Oh, and we're going to our first commercial break, but call in your questions at 718-497-2128, 718-497-2128. Cooking issues.
Oh, how you feel, brother? Feeling good. You feel good? Feeling good. Been so much bone, brother. Call your name. I don't want no people to know you're in here. How you feel, fella? Hey, yeah. Sure getting down. Look at him.
This is a public service announcement from Added Value. Join us Saturday, October 16th at the Red Hook Community Farm. Celebrate the harvest. Visit Brooklyn's largest urban farm. Delicious seasonal foods from local restaurants, EC, The Good Fork, Kevin's, The Lobster Pound, and Rice. And of course, pick up your produce at the Red Hook Farmers Market. For more information, call 718-855-5531. That's 718-855-5531. Or visit www.added-value.org. This has been a public service announcement from Added Value.
Brother,
yeah.
Now I want everybody, let's bread blow about two courses. And then I want to wave in, let's go and do that with this now, all right?
Yeah. All right.
I'm going to get that fella with the little horn over there.
Yeah.
You got James Horn on me.
Yeah,
Brad, can you take us higher?
Yeah.
Take us higher.
And welcome back to Cooking Issues. Call in your questions right now to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Coming to you live from Roberta's in Brooklyn, New York. Okay, we have some more of Colin's questions here. He has quite a few questions. We're going to try and hit them all. So Colin, to refresh you if you didn't listen to the first segment, Colin built his own vacuum machine, chamber vacuum machine, using a pump out of a compressor out of an air conditioner. And there's lots of, over the past couple of years, people who have done this kind of DIY chambers, but not just for food packing, for like making models, for doing vacuum bagging, like when they're doing resin. A lot of good reasons to build vacuum pumps out there, and a lot of sites with a lot of great information on it. So he asked a question: can the walls of quart-sized canning jars withstand a full vacuum, 14 PSI? Oh yes, they can. In fact, I use this trick all the time. If you have a vacuum machine and you don't have what's called gas flush. So when you're using a vacuum machine and you have gas flush, it means that you suck a vacuum in the bag. But you know, if you would then seal it and let the air come back in, let's say you had potato chips, bam, the potato chips would get smashed. Mm-hmm. When the air came back in, it would just get shattered and you'd have potato dust, which is not what you're looking for, right?
Yes.
So you have something called gas flush. And what that is that you suck all the air out, so all the moisture is gone. So now your potato chips are not going to go, and there's no oxygen, so the potato chips aren't going to go rancid. And they're not going to get soft and nasty. And then you inject a neutral gas back in, usually nitrogen, you know, sometimes depending on what you're doing, CO2 or some crazy mix depending on what you're doing. And then you seal it. And then when the air comes back in, there's a neutral gas in there so that its bag is still puffy. Your potato chips don't get smashed. And in fact, your potato chips are protected because they're inside of a pillow. So anyway, so this is a technique that you can use. If you don't have gas flush, which we just got actually in our new – we have a new vacuum machine in the school, and we'll be reporting on that at some point. But the if you don't have gas flush, quart and larger liter canning jars are a very good way to do it. I would get the – and they can take the pressure no problem. what I would do is I would get the ones, not the ones that have the thin metal lid that you then pry up. And the reason is that they seal once great, and then like after you open the lid to pry it up, like you make that noise when it pops up, a lot of times they won't reseal. I like the old style ones that have a glass lid and a glass base and a rubber gasket, and then you just set the lid with the gasket on top of your canning jar. Take all the metal hardware off of it. It's just going to get in your way. Suck the vacuum, and then when the vacuum comes back, the lid gets smashed back onto the top, and the actual vessel takes the pressure for you, not your potato chips or whatever the heck else you're going to pack. And those vacuums, I've had them last for months and months. Sometimes you'll get a bad seal on those, but you can usually tell within, you know, a couple of hours to a day that the seal on that jar is not going to be
good.
How
do you do it without a vacuum machine with those rubber seals?
Well, when you're canning with those things, usually the rubber seals, they have a lid on it, right? So you'd boil them.
Mm.
And, you know, you boil them, I guess you start boiling them and then maybe seal them while they're boiling. And then as it cools down, you'll suck a partial vacuum on the top and then you have to open it. I mean, it's like, I guess it's an old, I've never actually used them to can. I've only used them to package things. But they're great. You can get them in most houseware stores. And we use them all the time. So if you're bringing something that's crisp, like apple chips or potato chips or Methocel F50, meringue puffs, which is what we do a lot, you know, you can keep them for a long time, and you can, you know, travel in a rainstorm, you know, through Louisiana in a bayou. Well, it doesn't matter, and the stuff's not going to go bad on you. So it's actually a really good technique for bringing stuff with you. Not as good as having gas flush, but because it's just a pain in the butt. But anyway, so on the subject of vacuums, Colin wants to know that he's making apple chips, and he wants to get that same kind of same foamy texture that you get from doing freeze drying, and he wants to know how can you do that. Well, that's a pain in the butt, Colin, because freeze drying is a really good technique for doing that. Nothing else really approximates freeze drying the way freeze drying does. So the way a freeze dryer works is you freeze something, usually at a fairly low temperature to minimize the destruction of stuff to the cells quickly in a low temperature, and then you put a very strong vacuum on it, and you let it heat up slowly in that till the water inside of it basically sublimates. And what that means is you put it in a condition where the water doesn't want to go from a solid to a liquid and then to a gas. It just evaporates directly from a solid to a gas. And so what that means is that the structure of the product is held rigidly by the ice until the water leaves it, at which point it maintains its structure. And that's why you have things that look pretty much life size, but they have no more water in them. They're very porous, they're crunchy, they're great, and that's freeze drying. The problem is the equipment is usually somewhat expensive. You need a fairly good vacuum pump. You also need what's called a cold trap, because everything you suck off, you then need to recondense back. So you need a fairly cold trap. I've tried to do it kind of a ghetto style freeze dryer using my rotary evaporator, but my pump isn't quite good enough. My vacuum pump isn't quite good enough. So, you know, some people have one. Alex Talbot at Ideas and Food has one. You know, a couple of restaurants have them. I think maybe Laurent Gras might have one at L2O. I don't know. Anyway, we don't have a freeze dryer. Someday I'll have one. Anywho, so but there is an interesting patent that's been applied for. I think it's still under patent. So if you do this, you're going to be breaking all kinds of patent laws. I don't really care about that. But there's a technique called it's basically fruit puffing using vacuum and then carbon dioxide. And if you are the kind of person who can rip apart an air conditioner and build a vacuum chamber, then you are also the kind of person who can do this. And hopefully, I don't have time to do it, so maybe you can do it and tell me how it works. So here's what you do. First thing you do is you partially dehydrate a product till it's down to like about 60%, 20 to 60% water. You can do that with a standard dehydration, or you can use what's called osmotic dehydration. What that is you put your fruit into a very intense sugar syrup, and that draws the water out osmotically. That's osmotic dehydration. So you can do it that way. You could do it with a partial dehydration step. But the trick is to get rid of, I think, about half the water or so, a little under half the water. Then you take your apple slices at this point, and you put them into your vacuum chamber, and you suck a full vacuum on them for a little bit, right? Then you put a CO2 tank on, and you pressurize it to about, you know, a little over 200 PSI, right? So, and that's the minimum. It's about, they, in the patent literature, the minimum is about 200, 220 PSI of CO2. And you want to leave that for like 60 minutes under the high pressure CO2. So what's happening is the CO2 is going into the fruit, and it's basically getting, it's going all the way into the cells. And then you want to vent it over the course of like 30 seconds. So after that 60 minutes, you vent it over the course of 30 seconds, and the rapidly escaping CO2 takes with it the water and puffs the fruit up at the same time. So that's dehydrates, and any further dehydration you could probably do in a normal dehydrator or something like that. So it's a room temperature technique, so it's similar to freeze drying that way, and it doesn't require as much expensive equipment as a freeze dryer does. So if you can try this vacuum then CO2 puffing, Colin, I would be much obliged if you then tell us how it works and post pictures. But be extremely careful with pressure vessels. Make sure that you are using a pressure vessel that can handle the pressure. I don't want anyone blowing something up and, you know, basically creating a pipe bomb and killing themselves over something I said. So, you know, certain, you know, Schedule 40 pipe, which is a standard pipe you get, will not handle these kinds of pressures safely. Schedule 80 pipes, some Schedule 80 pipes can handle it. So be careful, make sure you know what you're doing. But I'd love to see someone try that, even though I think you'd be infringing on a bunch of patents and, you know, that they might come and arrest you. But, you know, again, hopefully not. And Colin's last question is, he's making an alginate bath and he wants to know how long he can keep it. All right, so I don't know, have we talked about this ever, the alginate bath?
No, I don't even think you talked about the pancakes.
The pancakes?
Yeah.
No, all right, well, we'll talk about this then. Okay. So sodium alginate is kind of very famous. It's made from seaweed, and what it does is it's the stuff that people make little balls out of in restaurants. Like, they call it caviar, blah, blah, blah. And the standard thing is you take, and by the way, it's also how they make the pimento on the inside of an olive. It's how they make fake onion rings. It's how they, you know, some dog foods are made this way. And so you take the seaweed, sodium alginate, and you mix it in, and whenever it touches anything with calcium in it, it all of a sudden turns to a gel. Right? So the standard technique that, you know, it was used for forever to make fake blueberries, and it was used also by science teachers who, you know, do it in science. But the famous early restaurant application was Ferran Adrià, who's actually coming to speak at the French Culinary today. Later today. He's going to be signing books and coming to the FCI. So Ferran, you know, famously made melon caviar out of alginate, and alginate in restaurants was born, right? Now, the problem with alginate is that it doesn't really have a great texture or taste. And so, in fact, it steals taste. It's like a flavor thief. So alginate, and also the other problem is that you make these balls, you drop alginate into calcium, it forms this beautiful sphere, but then over the course of the next couple of minutes, it turns solid. And once it turns solid, it's completely unpleasant. If it doesn't pop in your mouth, it's unpleasant. So then the next step is that, you know, chefs started doing what's called reverse alginate. So in reverse alginate, instead of dropping alginate into a calcium bath and forming these little balls, you're dropping calcium into an alginate bath, and then you get a little film of alginate around it, but the inside stays liquid forever, right? And so that is kind of, I think it's a better technique from a food standpoint. But then you have these alginate baths sitting around, and the question is, well, how long can you keep that alginate bath without it going bad? I've never kept one longer than about 2 or 3 days, but a lot of it depends on how heavily it's used, how much calcium, you know, touches it, and you have to use something called a sequestrant. And so what a sequestrant is a sequestrant sucks up the calcium that's inside of your solution and stops it from causing the alginate to react until there's so much calcium there that a reaction happens. Sodium citrate is kind of the sequestrant that people just have lying around. It's not so good. Sodium citrate is also a buffer, which is good, but it's kind of crap. You really want to use sodium hexametaphosphate. I'll say that again because that's a pain in the butt. Sodium hexametaphosphate. Hexametaphosphate, is that right? Anyway, call it SHIMP, S-H-M-P, SHIMP. And a little dab will do you on that one. You know, you get yourself a couple hundred grams of that, and that's a lifetime supply of SHIMP. And put it into your alginate bath, and it should last a good long time. We actually did a demo recently, Nastasha and I, for, what the heck was that show called?
Foodography.
Mm, yeah. I
mean, For the cooking channel.
I mean, it's not out yet or anything, but what we did with that was we wanted to do like our version of the McGriddle kind of, which is, you know, for those of you that, and I don't, I've never had a McGriddle, but it's basically McDonald's puts like crystals of maple syrup goop on the inside of their pancake. And the reason they're doing that is because the pancake becomes, I think, a sandwich.
Yeah, with egg inside.
Yeah, yes. Something like that. Anyway, so what we did is we did reverse algae. alginate. We mixed calcium with maple syrup and then put it into alginate. So we had these little balls of maple syrup that then when you bit into them, they pop. You actually get a pop of maple syrup. And we folded a bunch of them into a pancake batter, buttermilk pancake batter, your standard buttermilk pancake batter, and cook them. And they were actually pretty good, I thought.
Yeah, no, they were delicious.
They were delicious. So
you made them into silver dollars. So they were.
Yeah, right. Little silver dollar pancakes. So take that, McDonald's. But anyway, so it should, your alginate bath should last a good long time.
We're going to go to a break, Dave.
We are?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we're going to come back from our second session, but call in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Cooking Issues. Welcome back to Cooking Issues. Call in your questions to 718-497-2128, 718-497-2128. We're going to be here for about another 15 minutes. And by the way, we mentioned the list we're going to keep of questions we're going to ask McGee. He's in Japan right now, or we would call and ask him right now. But the man himself is coming to the French Culinary for his class next week?
The 21st and 22nd of October.
And there are still slots available for those of you that want to come meet the man in person and take the two-day McGee Lecture Series class at the French Culinary Institute. It's a class unlike any other, actually. We're going to be doing some ikijime, killing some fish. We might be doing... What else are we going to do?
You're getting a giant lobster.
I don't know where they're going to do a giant lobster. We're going to definitely do some lime juice. It's a class unlike any other. Let's just put it that way. You can go check it out on the French Culinary website, which is, I don't know, frenchculinary.com, right?
I think so.
Yeah. Okay. I have a question from Patrick Brawley, and he's wondering, in general, what percentage of ascorbic acid to use as an antioxidant? And so the thing is, ascorbic acid is... It's vitamin C, right? So, and we use it all the time when we're you know doing fruits like apples or anything else that's going to turn brown. We put ascorbic acid in to prevent it from turning brown. In fact, we put ascorbic acid into apple juice as we make it. It'll stay green and fresh tasting until it actually spoils. It'll never go brown. It'll never have that oxidized apple taste. And the question of percentage is an interesting one. I spoke to Nils about it actually this morning. We always just add by eye. We've never actually measured how much ascorbic acid we're doing. It's not hypercritical how much you use it, but I did some research, and usually how much you use depends on your application. So if you're going to let's say you're cutting apples, and you're going to put ascorbic acid into the water, and you're going to try to keep it, then it's usually a higher dose. Or if you're going to dehydrate it, then afterwards you want the ascorbic acid enough to get on the apple to have it really make a difference. Then you're going to probably use something on the order of 6 grams a liter, something like that, right? But if you're adding it to juice, then you probably need a lot less. You probably need like maybe half of that, like 3 grams per liter, or you know something like that. But we usually just add like you know a teaspoon or so to per quart or something like that, mm-hmm. or less. But you know, it doesn't really affect the flavor that much. Ascorbic acid is a much lower has a much lower impact on flavor than like citric acid. Which brings me to my next point: never confuse citric acid and ascorbic acid. Ascorbic acid is vitamin C. Ascorbic acid is the antioxidant. Citric acid, and it does not taste like lemons. It has an acidic taste, but it doesn't taste like lemons. Citric acid does not have the same antioxidant power as ascorbic acid. Citric acid does taste like the acid in lemons, right? But they're often confused. Sour salt that you buy in the supermarket is citric acid, right? You want to make sure you get ascorbic acid. And when you buy ascorbic acid, if you go to a GNC or whatever, your vitamin store, and you buy vitamin C powder or pills. You want to make sure you get the straight stuff and not stuff that's like got rose hips and all this other nonsense, because that's going to add flavor, and you're really not looking to add flavor to your product.
Wait, so if you're going to make apple cider and you put it in there, is it not going to turn the apple cider brown?
It's not only not going to turn the apple cider brown, it's not going to taste like apple cider. Mm. It's going to taste like fresh apples, right? So when we're doing work where we want the apple, we want the characteristic flavor of an apple. Like, let's say we're juicing, my favorite, Ashmead's Kernel, right? I want the juice to taste like, that's an apple variety. And by the way, Nastasha and I, next week when we go to London, we're going to go to the Brogdale collection, which is, Cornell has the finest collection of, biggest, I mean, and also finest, I guess, collection of apples in the world. But they also have a lot of non-culinary apples. The Brogdale, which is you know the UK's apple collection in Kent, which is outside of London, they have the largest collection of culinary apples in the world. So Nastasha and I are going to go there, and I'm going to eat so many apples that that basically they have to shove a needle in my stomach and like evacuate all of the craziness. I'm going to eat apples until I pass out. Basically, I've become allergic to apples actually over the last couple of years. So I'm going to bring a whole bunch of Benadryl with me, and I'm gonna wait until my throat starts to swell. I'm gonna inject myself with epinephrine and take Benadryl, because I'm there to eat as many apples as is humanly possible, and we'll report back. Anyway, so if you're juicing Ashmead's Kernel, which I hope to taste next week, because our supplier of Ashmead's Kernel was destroyed this year because there was a killing frost in parts of the Northeast this year. Anyway, when you're juicing it and you want that taste of the fresh apple, if you want the juice to taste like you just bit into that apple, minus the crunch, mm-hmm. then you use ascorbic acid, and it's going to retain its original color and its original flavor. It's not the flavor we associate with apple juice. The flavor we associate with apple juice and apple cider is that brown flavor, because mm-hmm. the oxidation doesn't just change the color, it also changes the flavor. And so you only add it if you're looking for that fresh flavor, and you don't add it if you want that cider and or juice flavor. But that said, I love that fresh flavor, and it makes really great mixers. And so if you're juicing your own apples, we go through ascorbic acid like it's going out of style. The other question Patrick had is he was trying to make an agar gel. I had a lot of hydrocolloid questions this time. Yeah.
Well, you're having the class coming up too.
I would push the class, but it's sold out.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's sold out. Like, we do a hydrocolloids class at school where we teach you how to use all of these things, like agar, xanthan, also meat glue, which is transglutaminase. We're going to show you how to use SPL, which is the enzyme we use to do clarifications. All this stuff, it's great. But unfortunately, I think the class, I mean, maybe it's not sold out. Check it on thefrenchculinary.com. I think it's sold out. I'm not sure. Anyway, so Patrick's making an agar gel. Agar is another seaweed gel. It's a great one. I highly recommend that, you know, if you're just starting playing with hydrocolloids, use agar, because you can use it to clarify, you can use it to set gels, you can use it to make fluid gels, which are one of my favorite things to do with hydrocolloids in the kitchen. But he wants to make the problem with agar is agar is brittle, right? So it breaks very easily. He's trying to increase the elasticity, and he says, and typically you would do that by adding another gum called locust bean gum, another natural gum. That one's from basically ground up seeds. And so the question is that he doesn't want to use, and the locust bean gum basically just modifies the agar so it's less brittle, right? So it's a lot of times if you add like a thickener like that to a gel, so a thickener's locust bean gum, agar is a gel, you can make it a little bit softer. And he says, is there anything else you can use? Well, because he says LBG, locust bean gum, in the biz we call it LBG, that it's too expensive. I don't know what the per pound cost is on LBG when you're buying it, but you're not going to use that much. I would go ahead and buy the LBG. I mean, unless you're making, because, you know, 1 pound of LBG should be more than enough to do 200 or more, 300 pounds of just as a softener of agar gel. So I don't know what they're charging for. I mean, check Terra Spice in the U.S. I don't know, or Le Sanctuaire, they sell it. But the problem is you can go with a much cheaper gum like guar, but guar, it tastes terrible. Guar is another bean. It's very similar to locust bean gum. Not quite as good probably at modifying the texture, but it will work. The problem with guar is, like I say, is it tastes horrible unless you buy flavor-free guar from TIC Gums. But I don't know how cheap the TIC Gums flavor-free guar is. But that is one way around it. So hopefully that is helpful. And we have one last question from Norway. Eric from, with the real spelling with the K, mm-hmm. like that, anyway. So Eric from Norway writes in, and he's in a restaurant in Norway, and he's making a lot of lobster stock. And he's making a lobster stock and then reducing it for use later. And he says that he's getting a good taste out of the lobster stock. Presumably, he's doing it traditional way, which is you break up the lobster shells, you roast and or break up, or both. I don't know whichever order, doesn't really matter, till you get some color on them, and then you break them up, and then you cook them in liquid to extract the flavor from the shells. Right? That's typically. Then you would strain out the shells, and then you would use the stock. After that, he reduces it, makes a reduction out of it. He says it's usable, but it doesn't taste like fresh lobster. Do you have a better way to do it? And can he do it in a pressure cooker? And because he needs an excuse to get one. Well, I will do anything I can. Send me a menu. I'll give you an excuse to buy a pressure cooker. But this is not that excuse, because I was talking to Nils about this actually earlier today. One of the main problems people have when they make any sort of crustacean stock is they boil the shells too long, and all of a sudden the stock will take on this, like, horrible, we ascribe it, I don't know technically whether it is, but Nils and I always call it the calcium taste. And it all of a sudden starts to taste not like the shellfish itself, but like literally like you're chewing on shells. And we ascribe that to like maybe the calcium being leached out. So while I've never done it, so I'm always horrified. I'm always making sure that people don't leave the shells in my stocks too long when we're doing it, because I dread that taste. Once you pull it out and you reduce it, that's fine. You're never going to get that taste. But anyway, so Nils, so don't use a pressure cooker on that one, because I'm almost guaranteeing you that the higher temperature is going to cause an increased release of that stuff, and you're going to get that taste. I'm almost guaranteeing it because I haven't actually done it, but that's my feeling. That's my strong feeling that that's what's going to happen. But Nils said that because he had tested this, I asked him whether he could get a fresher flavor. If you don't roast the shells beforehand, you're not going to have as intense a flavor, but maybe it's going to be okay because you're going to reduce it. But it might be closer to a fresh lobster flavor. Another thing, Eric had asked whether he can clarify the stock and is he going to lose a lot of flavor out of it. I don't think he's going to lose a lot of flavor if you clarify your stock, like doing a gel clarification like that. But if you're preserving the oil, he said he had the oil on the top of the stock, and he takes the oil off, he emulsifies it back into the stock anyway. If you're going to emulsify oil back into the stock as part of a reduction, I don't necessarily see the point in clarifying it, because it's going to make it unclear once you emulsify the oil in anyway. So if you're going to have oil in it, I don't see the point of clarifying it. But clarifying the water phase by itself isn't, I don't think, going to damage the flavor that much. It might make it cleaner, a little lighter, but cleaner. One last suggestion I have for you to really extract some flavor out of it is you might consider breaking the shells up, either roasting them or not, depending on what flavor you want, and then doing circulating some butter in the shells first to extract some of the oil-soluble flavors, basically making like a lobster butter. Reserve that, then do a stock with that, suck out all the water-soluble stuff, then reduce that, then do your emulsifying, like almost like you were finishing the reduction with the basically lobster butter you've made, and then you should get the maximum amount of flavor out of those shells without sucking out the evil, nasty calcium bits. And, you know, if you do it right, you should be able to get, you know, maybe a fresher flavor. Like maybe you could also maybe do the butter poach before you roast them, and then roast them, and then you could do all sorts of combinations. But again, I'm very curious as to what happens. So, you know, you should write in, hopefully, and tell us what happened. Just don't put it in the pressure cooker. But I love pressure cookers. Again, I'll give you any excuse. Ask me any other question. I'll tell you need a pressure cooker, but not for that one. One last question I had, it actually came into the blog, but I'll just answer it here, is can you make bananas justino without a centrifuge, and can you do it with agar clarification? So for those of you that haven't come to any of our events recently, one of our favorite new drinks, in fact, we did it at the Heritage Radio Network fundraiser a couple weeks ago, is bananas justino. And the derivation of the name is too silly to go into now, but basically we make a rum banana justino and we make a bourbon banana justino. So what you do is you blend bananas. So when you're doing bourbon banana justino, it's five bananas per liter of bourbon, and you blend them. You add a little bit of our magical enzyme Pectinex SPL, which is a genius. In fact, it doesn't, that recipe doesn't work without it, because we tested it at the New York Culinary experience, the event we did. What was that, last week? Was that only last week? Holy, holy crap. Anyway, so you blend it together, you put it in a centrifuge, and you spin it at 4,000 G's for like, 15 minutes, and you get this delicious clear bourbon with banana in it. And then we make ice cubes that are basically, either, if we're going to use it today, it's brown sugar, lemon, and water. If we're going to use it tomorrow, and vanilla, it's brown sugar, citric acid, and water, and vanilla, if we're going to use it later. Anyway, and so it's a great drink, and it's garnished with candied ginger. It's great. We love it. Anyway, so that particular drink needs a centrifuge, but you could do an agar clarification of it. I don't know what your yield is going to be, so you might have to add, your yield might be I know your yield won't be as good. So what you would do, and the other problem with agar clarification with bourbon is that if you don't have access to liquid nitrogen, the bourbon won't freeze. So, but you could do quick agar clarification. I was thinking freeze thaw. My brain just went on zorch. You could do quick agar. So then what you would do is you would blend the bananas and the bourbon. You would, I would take some water, right? I would hydrate. So we'll do an actual recipe here, right? Let's say you blend, what do you think? I don't know, like 200 grams of bananas, mm-hmm. and a liter of bourbon. So that's roughly 1200 milliliters, right? Let's say you took 400 mils of water. What is that? 1800?
Yeah.
Shoot. 1800?
No, that's 1600.
Well, I can't do the math. Anyway, then 0.2% of that. So let's say it was 2 liters. Let's say you had 2 liters of stuff. You would take 4 grams of agar. You would then hydrate that in the water portion. Don't add the water to the bourbon and blended bananas. Hydrate it in your water portion. Make sure that you put the agar into the water cold. Make sure it boils and then simmers for a couple of minutes to make sure it's hydrated. Temper your bourbon back and bananas back into the water, and then let that set. And once it sets, break it up with a whisk and like gently pass it through cheesecloth. Again, I don't know what your yield will be, but it should get a similar result. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason we use a centrifuge is I have three.
The events are usually upwards of 300 people attending. So
yeah, I mean, you could definitely make it at home this way. But like our yield is just so high using we get almost zero loss when we do it in the centrifuge, and so that's the reason we use the centrifuge. But you can definitely make bananas justino at home using agar and bananas and bourbon, and I almost guarantee you it will work. Right? No?
Yes.
All right. So next week, save up your questions. We will be doing live from London. But unlike last week when we did it, we are going to be, both Nastasha and I will both be in London. And so I think Jack is going to be our local host. Is that true? Jack, our intrepid engineer who doesn't come on the air very often, but runs the show here basically. Without it, we wouldn't have it. But before we go, I will leave you with this one thing. So we went, we did an event on last Saturday?
Yesterday, too. 3 days ago.
What was the name of the event again?
It was Live Fit or Die, or no, Fun Fit in the City.
Fun Fit, Live Fit or Die. Where did you get that? It's crazy. Fun Fit in the City. Anyway, we were at the Discovery Zone. It's called, right? It's a school. It's a charter school in Harlem on 125th Street and was it Madison or Fifth? I forget.
Between both. Yeah.
Anyway, so it's actually an amazing school. We went to visit it. It's really incredible. It's like, it's a huge place. It looks amazing. Like, it's the kind of school I wish I could have gone to when I was a kid. Anyway, we were doing an event there for the Liberty Science Center and the Food Network, who were putting an event together, and they were talking about nutrition. And so they asked, they asked us to go up and do a demonstration that somehow had something to do with nutrition for like a couple hundred people. And immediately, of course, junemic acid popped into my head. So junemic acid is the thing we use that erases your sense of sweet. So we passed out a bunch of junemic acid, which is a leaf basically from the Gymnema sylvestri. It's a plant from India, low nucleus, the sugar destroyer. And you eat this incredibly awful tasting leaf powder, and for about half an hour you can't taste anything sweet at all. No sweetness. And so we passed out the powder, and along with bananas, not bananas justino, it was because it was all kids, so no liquor, unfortunately, strawberries, marshmallows, chocolate, sugar, honey, and I think a couple other things. Anyway, we passed them out in bags, and we're basically trying to show people you know, what food items taste like without the sugar in it. And we actually do that demo in the McGee class. Anyway, so we had a bunch of people there, and then I was on stage. And a lot, by the way, like, we opened it, right? So we were kind of the opening band. But, you know, they had Rachel Ray was on next, and Mehmet Oz, and some guy from Men's Health who I don't remember
yeah,
his name.
Some
and
basketball player.
Alonzo Mourning. Real, yes. Yeah, I mean, a real dude. Anyway, it's like real people. Anyway, so, you know, unlike us. And So I'm sitting there, and I felt bad that, you know, that the people didn't have more to eat. And plus, there was a huge bowl of oranges on the counter. And so I open up the orange so I can taste the orange. Oh, pineapple juice. I taste the orange to see kind of how bad the orange tastes without sugar. It was awful. And so then I'm sitting here eating an orange, and now I feel like a bad host because I have all these people out in the audience and they don't have any oranges. And of course, I have nowhere near enough oranges for like all the people in the audience. And like an idiot, I say, oh, because I'm eating this orange, oh, would any of you like to have an orange? And of course, everyone's hands shoot up, right? Immediately. So I'm like, crap. And so now I'm like, you know, like the t-shirt gun lady, you know, I'm like hurling oranges out into the audience. Now, I'm not exactly like Captain Catch and Throw here. You know what I mean? In fact, I told this one guy, I was like, sir, you know, I'm not very good at throwing things. I got to him fine. He was a catch. So then my biggest fear was I was going to, in fact, I think I said, it's like, I'm going to bean someone with one of these damn oranges. And I hit a lady square in the head with an orange. I bounced the orange straight off the top of her head. I was like, I saw her hands were there. It wasn't actually a bad throw. Maybe it was a little too much of a line drive to her, but her hands were there and the hand didn't close around the orange in time. And it bounced off of her head and the lady behind her caught it. So it's total orange pandemonium. But I think no one came up and tried to beat the crap out of me afterwards.
But
so I think
that was our first real event.
That was our
with
first
real people.
Yeah. Anyway. No. So that was a lot of fun, and hopefully those guys got something out of it. Anyway, so get your questions ready for Cooking Issues coming to you live from London next week. This has been Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network, brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards, Fine Country Hams.
Vicious vodka. Oh, you dirty rat, got me on this corner, and I don't know where I'm at. Supposed to meet my baby, I'm 20 minutes late.